Studies from the 18th chapter of the book of Matthew on relationships. There is no chapter, no single chapter, I suppose, in all of the Gospels that talks more about the Christian and his relationship and the disciples' relationship than does Matthew, the 18th chapter. We mentioned in our last study how that problems in relationships often come because of the following problems. Sometimes they come because we're focusing on ourselves, because we're inflated with pride. We think a lot of ourselves. Sometimes it comes because we do not value another person as being important. Sometimes it's because we don't resolve the differences that have arisen. Or maybe we fail to forgive. And we pointed out the fact that Jesus dealt with all of those in the context of Matthew chapter 18. He addressed those very questions. Matthew chapter 18 talks so much about these relationships. In our first study, we talked about the question of who is the greatest. In verses 1 through 9 of Matthew 18, the question was raised, who is the greatest in the kingdom? The question was in chapter 18 and in verse 1. Jesus gives his answer in verses 2 through 4. But what is interesting is the warning that he gives in 5 through 9. And the warning is important because that sets the pace for the next section of verses. In verses 5 through 9, he warned about causing one of these little ones to offend. That is, causing one of the disciples to sin and lead them astray. And he said, there's a danger in that. Keep that in mind as we go even further. Now, having established the fact that there is a possibility of doing someone wrong, because that was the point of verses 5 through 9, was it not? That it is possible and there is a danger that you could do someone else wrong. Let's raise the question. Do you ever feel that you've been done wrong? Has there ever been a time that you thought someone did you wrong, and particularly that you felt like a fellow Christian has done you wrong? And they have sinned against you somehow. Well, then what do you do about that? How do you respond to that? What do you do when a fellow Christian has done you wrong? And who should I tell? Should I go and just tell them and don't tell anybody else? Or should I go and tell some other people so that I can get some advice from them? Should I go to the elders first? Or do I go to my closest friend and tell them? What do I do? And what should be my feelings about the person? Do I have a right to despise them somehow and look down upon them? Or should I not look that way toward them? What do I do? And who is to say how you're to react? Who is the one that is to say, this is the way you react to that? Is that something you decide for yourself? Or do you go to the elders and let them tell you, this is how you need to react to that? Or is there some other source that tells you? And another question is, who should you have with you? Someone has done you wrong and you want to talk to them about that. Should you take somebody with you? And when should you take somebody with you? Should you be by yourself? Should you get the elders? What do you do? How do you handle this? When someone has done you wrong, what do you do? Well, chapter 18, beginning at verse 10 through 20, is the very section that talks about that. When you have been wronged. The question in verses 1 through 8 was, who is the greatest? But at the end of that, I'm trying to connect, if you haven't already caught that connection, that he warned that sometimes we do people wrong. And so now he talks about the question, when you have been wronged, in verses 10 through 20. There are three different sections here in verses 10 through 20, and I want to look at them in sections. First of all, verses 10 to 14. Let's read. See what we see in verses 10 to 14. Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones, the little ones that were mentioned in verse 5. For I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountain to seek the one who is straying? And if he should find it, assuredly I say to you, he rejoices more over that sheep than over the 99 that did not go astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven, that one of these little ones should perish. And we're going to pick up at verse 15 in a moment. What we just saw there in verses 10 through 14 was the attitude that's wrong. He just discussed an attitude that's wrong when you have been wronged. There's an attitude that's not right, and he addressed that in verses 10 to 14, if you didn't catch that. that is wrong, and we need to talk about that. But let's pick up at verse 15 now. Beginning in verse 15, he said, "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. And if he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that at the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses to even hear the church, let him be like to you like a heathen and a tax collector." Now, what he just told us in those three verses was the action that is right. The attitude that was wrong, here is the action that is right. Here's how you deal with this. Not how. You don't deal with it like verse 10 talked about. You deal with it like 15 to 17 talks about. Now let's continue our reading. Let's pick up at verse 18. "Assuredly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatsoever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. And again I say to you, if two of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them." Now he just told us a third thing. And that is, here's the authority that works. The attitude that's wrong, the action that is right, and the authority that works. And that's the three things he just told us here in these verses about when you have been wrong. What do you do when you have been wrong? Well, let's start with this. Let's go back to verses 10 to 14 and talk about the attitude that he just talked about that was wrong. What was the attitude that was wrong? Well, notice that he uses the word despise. Verse 10. Here's the attitude that's wrong. When you have been wrong somehow, and someone has sinned against you, and you have been treated wrong, what do you do? Well, don't do this. Look at verse 10. "Take heed that you do not despise." Well, let's raise a question. What does that mean, to despise? You say, "I don't know that I despise anybody. And I don't think I have ever despised some brother or sister in the Lord, that even those that I think have wronged me, I don't think I've ever done that." But let's just see what the word means. Strong says the word means to think against. Well, it probably involves more than that, but Strong suggests that literally, and it's usually a literal rendering that Strong gives, that it means to think against. A.T. Robertson makes this observation, literally, to think down on, with the assumption of superiority. May go back and connect with our pride of verse 3 and 4. "That you despise them in the sense you look down upon them with a feeling of superiority. Particularly in this context, when they have done me wrong, then I think that I am quite superior to them. And I'm going to look down with despisal toward them." It means to have contempt for another. I have contempt for them because they haven't done me right. And furthermore, it means to hate them as per 1 John 3 and 15. Without taking the time to turn there, 1 John 3 and verse 15 talks about hating your brother. And verse 15 defines that hatred as a lack of love. So it may be that I despise them in the sense I don't love them like I should. And I'm not showing the concern for them like 15 to 17 shows. And so in that sense, I do despise them. Now, let's go a little further. But let's raise now the question of why do I not despise them? Why, what reason does he give me in the context? He says at verse 10, "Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones." When someone has done you wrong, when someone not only has done you wrong, but they have just sinned, which is also included, by the way, in the context of 5 through 9. Make sure you don't despise them. But why do I not despise? Why shouldn't I look down upon someone who sinned? Why shouldn't I feel superior to them when they're the ones that have done wrong? Why shouldn't I feel this way? Well, he gives a reason. Look at verse 10. He said, "For," here's the reason, "I say to you that in heaven their angels do always see the face of our Father who is in heaven." We do it because of the angels that he mentions. We'll come back to that in a moment, but I want you to look at this consideration. That is, the one who is despised, as being despised, as we've already mentioned, in verses 6 through 9, because they have sinned. Verse 6 mentions that. Verse 7 mentions that. But I want to give you further evidence before we go back to the question of the angels at verse 10, that he is comparing the one that has been done, who has done wrong, to a sheep that has gone astray. And we'll get to that in a moment in 12 to 14. But he talks about the sheep that has gone astray. So they're compared to that. Somehow, this person that has done some wrong that you might be despising is like the sheep gone astray. So they've done some kind of wrong. They've sinned. So they've been caused to sin, verses 6 through 9. They've gone astray, 12 to 14. In context with 15 to 17, they've sinned against you somehow. And furthermore, verses 21 to 35 we'll talk about next week, they are in need of forgiveness. Four evidences in the context that the reason that you might be despising them, the reason you might be looking down upon them is because they've done wrong. That may be the reason you feel superior to them somehow. But let's raise the question, could I be guilty of that? Is there any way in which I might be guilty of despising this person? Could I be guilty of somehow looking down upon them? Well, I want to suggest to you that any time I do any of the following, any time that I have bitter feelings towards some brother or sister, any time that I think someone is not worthy of reaching for, there may be some that I would look at and think, you know what, they're worth reaching for and they're worth trying to salvage and they're worth trying to make some effort to bring them back. But here is another I don't think is worth reaching for them. I don't think they're worth reaching for. And any time I view another as being a less disciple and an unworthy disciple, I might be despising another as per the context of verse 10. I could be guilty of that. Now then, let's go to verses 10 through 14 and talk about the reasons where we just started a moment ago. What's the reason now that I give, or that the text gives, for saying you don't despise them? Well, the first thing he mentions, as we just read a moment ago, at verse 10, is the angels. Something about angels has to do with that. What's he talking about? Well, there is no evidence, as some have cited the verse, and somehow evidence that there are such a thing, or there is such a thing as guardian angels. Well, let's stop and talk about that just for a moment. The idea of a guardian angel is the fact that you have a particular angel that watches over you and cares for you and protects you and that does things for you. And the reason that you were almost killed in that accident but you weren't is you had a guardian angel watching for you. Well, that raises a question in my mind. What about this person over here that was faithful and diligent in all of their service to the Lord and they did get killed in their accident? What happened to their guardian angel? What was they doing? And was their guardian angel not working that day? Were they off on base? What's going on? Why didn't that guardian angel work? And when bad things did happen, and they do happen to good people, Job, where was this guardian angel? There is no evidence of guardian angels anywhere in the Old or New Testament. So what is this talking about? Well, it may suggest that angels in general guard disciples. There is no evidence that you have a guardian angel that watches for you. But it may suggest that there is a sense in which angels work on our behalf. Now, there is evidence that that is the case. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 1, if you will. And when I get through reading chapter 1, I probably have more questions than I have answers to the question of angels and what they do. But chapter 1 and verse 14 suggests that angels somehow work for us in some way. Now, look at verse 14. He's talking about angels in the context and how Christ is superior to angels. But here's something about angels. Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for those who inherit salvation? That's us. If you're set to inherit salvation, angels are sent forth as a ministering spirit. Now then, ask me the question, how do they do that? And my answer is, I don't know. Ask me, what do they do? I don't know. I just have to be satisfied with the fact that in some way they work on our behalf. Again, no evidence of guardian angels at all. It might refer, let's go back to Matthew chapter 22 now, closer to our context of Matthew 18. Chapter 22 may suggest that their spirits become angels somehow. Look at Matthew chapter 22 and in verse 30. For in the resurrection they neither marry nor given in marriage, but are like angels of God in heaven. In heaven, they're like angels. That may refer, and I suggest and underscore that I may, that their spirits become angels. When we get through with that, I'm not sure exactly in the sense that verse 10 is saying that angels have some play in this, but the point is, the reason I am not to despise them is because of angels somehow. Either they have angels watching over them, or maybe they become angels, or angels are working on their behalf. But because of that, he says, don't despise them. That's a reason that's given. Here's a second reason that's given. Look at verse 11. Verse 11 suggests that Christ came to save them. Back to Matthew 18 at verse 11. For the Son of Man came to save that which was lost. The reason I am not to despise this one who has sinned, but rather, verses 15 to 17, have the right action, is because Christ came to save me. He came to save me, that's true. But this one that does me wrong, Christ came to save them too. Doesn't mean they're going to be saved, but he wants them to be saved like anyone else. He's focusing on the value, indeed, of the soul. Now, I want you to notice at verses 12 to 14, picturing that concept of the value of the soul, let's talk about verses 12 to 14. He said, what do you think? To a man, he gives the illustration of the sheep that's gone astray. A man has 100 sheep, and one of them goes astray. Does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountain to seek the one that is straying? And when he finds that one, verse 13, that he rejoices more over that sheep than over the 99? What he's focusing on is the value of one soul. It's just one person. It's just one person. Yeah, that's one person, but that's just one soul. And that's valuable. And that's important. And so he says at verse 14, even so it is not the will of the Father in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. He doesn't want anybody to be lost. He wants everybody to be saved. Here's the point, that every individual is still the object of the Savior's love, and so that's why I'm not to have that wrong attitude. I'm not to have that despisal, verse 10. Because of angels, because Christ came to save them, and because of the value of the soul. Now let's notice a contrast now. Beginning at verse 15, he talks about the action that is right. Rather than have this attitude that is wrong, 10 to 14, here is the action that is right. Now notice the contrast. Rather than having this attitude of despisal, on the contrast, you approach them with compassion and with care and with concern. So he's not saying don't. You look at someone who sinned and just ignore that because they are to be loved like everybody else. That's not what he's saying. He's saying when they have sinned, rather than despise them, you approach them with compassion. Here's the action that is right. What does he say about that? Well, I want to talk about three things here. In the context, he talks about the sin. And then I want us to see the point in the context. And then we want to talk about the rebuke. Let's talk about those three things. Let's talk about the sin first of all. In verses 15 to 17, as he talks about, if a brother has sinned against you, go and tell him it's all between you and him alone. He is talking about a private sin and not a public sin. Why is that important? Well, if we're going to apply the principles of the verse, we need to apply them properly. And let's get the context. The context is not talking about a public sin where someone is guilty of public drunkenness, for example. Or one has been guilty of teaching a false doctrine publicly. You say, why do you mention that? Because quite often when someone has done something wrong in a public forum, in a public manner, and it's known to everybody in the church, known in the community, there are people who appeal to Matthew 18 and say, you know what? You didn't handle that right. They should not have been rebuked publicly. They should not have been dealt with in the way because Matthew 18 says you need to go between you and him alone. This is not talking about a public sin. This is talking about a private sin. You say, how do you know? Let's look at the evidence. Look at verse 15. You might underline in your Bible, if you don't already have it, that if your brother sins, here's the next two words, against you. Why underline that? This is not just a sin, but it is a sin against you. This is a private sin. Second evidence. The private interview says that the sin is private. You say, what do you mean private interview? If your brother has sinned against you, you go tell him his fault between you and him alone. You know what that means? No one else knows about it yet. So your brother's done you wrong? The fact that you have a private interview with him and you have a private discussion, just the two of you, tells me this was not a public sin, this is a private sin. Thirdly, notice that in the context, Peter asked, something that was said in the context made Peter ask this question. Look at verse 21. We'll get to this next week. Peter came to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin? You ready? Underline the next two words. Against me. That's a private sin. It's a personal matter. Sin, yes. Public, no. So let's understand what the nature of the sin is here in the context. Now let's get the point of that thing. Now that we know the nature of the thing under consideration, let's get the point of that. There are times when sin is personal and private and something between the two parties and God. If we don't get anything else and we get that point from Matthew 18, that's going to help us a lot. There are times when there is sin that is personal and is private between the two parties and God and doesn't involve anybody else. You say, what do you learn from that? Well, there's two things I learned. Number one, the more private matters are kept private matters, the less public trouble we'll have. Would you agree with that? The more private matters are kept private matters, the less public trouble we will have. You get that principle fixed in our minds, because what often happens in local churches, and I'm thankful we're not in that circumstance at the moment, though perhaps we've been in the past, this kind of thing serves to warn us to keep us from doing that again in the future. But sometimes there may be problems arise between two people, and the next thing you know, you've got families taking sides, and you've got brethren beginning to take sides, and you have people pulling in different directions who have bits and pieces of information. And it started with two people, and now it's permeated through the whole church, and it should never get that far if they follow the principle. Let me emphasize again, the more private matters are kept private matters, the less public trouble we'll have. So someone does me wrong, and I feel like they have done me wrong somehow. What do? I deal with them and keep it a private matter, and you should never have known about it or heard about it because we settled that issue. And nobody ever knew we had a problem. The more private matters are kept private matters, the less public trouble we'll have. Second thing I learned, that public matters are not to be treated as private matters. I've known of a number of brethren, and you have too perhaps. Maybe here's a public doctrine that was taught. Error was taught publicly. And you go to the elders and you ask, well, what are we going to do about that? Well, we settled that privately. No, you didn't. You haven't said it. Something needs to be done about that. Something needs to be addressed, because this was a public matter and Matthew 18 did not come to play here, because this is dealing with a private sin. A whole different ball game. Quite often a man teaches error and you respond to him publicly and call his name, and someone says, you didn't follow the principles of Matthew 18. You didn't go to him first, did you? And then take with you one or two more and then tell it to the whole church. No, I didn't. And I ain't going to either. You say, why? Because that's not what's under consideration here. It's not under consideration. Private sin, it's a different matter. Now let's get the rebuke, beginning at verse 15. There is a primary approach, a secondary approach, and then there's a final approach. Let's talk about all three. In the primary approach, verse 15, this is the first step. If your brother has sinned against you, you go tell him his fault between you and him alone, and if he hears you, you have gained your brother. What is the primary approach? This is where the offended goes to the offender. Does the offender ever have the responsibility to go to the offended? Yes, sir. Matthew 5 will talk about that, but that's not under consideration here. This time, you are the one who has been done wrong, and you have the responsibility to go to the one that has wronged you. Sometimes their attitude is, I didn't do any wrong. They need to come crawling to me. They need to come apologizing to me. That's not what this text says. This text says, you have the responsibility as the offended to go to the offender. Furthermore, you go to him for this purpose, to tell him his sin. Notice that's definite, specific. Here is what you have done that is wrong. Here is what you have done that is in a violation of the will of God. And here's where you have sinned against me. This is not a matter about you hurt my feelings and I didn't like what you said, and you said something that kind of, well, it just hurt my feelings when you said it. Not what's under consideration. It's where you have sinned against me and your soul is in danger because of that. Furthermore, notice at verse 15, the purpose thereof is to gain your brother. Notice the attitude with which he described. Notice in verse 10, he talked about an attitude that was wrong.
You despise him because you're not trying to gain him. He's not worth gaining. You're not trying to gain him. You don't care about him. But at verse 15, you do care about him because your motive in going is not to get him told, not to finally get your chance to get even with him, but your goal is you're trying to gain him. It has everything to do with the manner in which you approach him. You approach him with the attitude, what can I do to gain them rather than push them astray? And furthermore, notice this primary approach is an attempt to keep a private matter private. That's why you go and approach this person between you and him alone. And you don't take with you two or three more. You're not telling it to the elders. You're not telling it to your best friend. You're going between you and him alone, and that's all that knows about it, and you're going to keep it that way. Why do you do that? Perhaps Barnes suggested that and explained it the best. Barnes said that. Here's why you do that. He said, you do that. This is required. That he may have the opportunity of explaining his conduct. In 9 cases out of 10, where one supposes that he's been injured, a little friendly conversation will set the matter right, prevent the difficulty. Isn't that true? Quite often, it's the case that you go and you tell someone, you sinned against me. You did me wrong. 9 times out of 10, as Barnes says, quite often it was a misunderstanding. Maybe they didn't mean what you thought they meant. Maybe they didn't actually say what you thought they said. Maybe they didn't do what you thought they did. Gives them a chance to explain. Now that's settled, isn't it? Secondly, why do you do it? Well, then they might have the opportunity of acknowledging the offense or making reparation if he's done wrong. Many would be glad for such an opportunity. It is our duty to furnish them, but calling upon them. In other words, if you were the one that had done the wrong, wouldn't you rather somebody come to you and say, I'm going to give you an opportunity to correct that before I tell anybody else. I haven't told the elders, I haven't told anybody. It's just between me and you, and would you correct that now so it doesn't go any further? Wouldn't you be wanted to be afforded that opportunity? Thirdly, Barnes suggests that we admonish them of their error if they've done any injury to the cause of religion. Maybe their sin against me, I might add, has not only offended me and sinned against me and done me wrong, but it may lead to the offense of religion as a whole and the cause of Christ. This should not be blazoned abroad. It can do no good. It does injury. It is what our enemies of religion wish. Christ is often wounded in the house of his friends, and religion as well, as an injured brother, often suffers by the spreading of such faults before the world. He said, we do nothing but endanger their reputation, perhaps ours too, and the danger of reputation of the church by spreading abroad. Here's why this brother has done me wrong. That's why you follow the primary approach. Here's the secondary approach. The secondary approach is found in verse 16. It's your second step. Look at verse 16. He said, if he will not hear you, what does that mean? That means you went to talk to him, just the two of you. And he refused to acknowledge the wrong, refused to correct the wrong, and you're still insistent that indeed he's done you wrong. So now what do you do? Take with you one or two more, that at the mouth of two of the witnesses every word may be established. This time you're taking others with you. You didn't do that the first time. You don't approach them by gathering two or three people and going the first time. This is on your second approach. Take with you two or three more. The mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. What it does is it causes the offender to begin to ask, is it really this serious? And I should have put there, it causes the offended to do the same. You think about the wisdom of God in that. When God said, now the second approach is, you now take one or two more, that at the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. It makes you begin to think, have I really been done that bad and that wrong? Is it that serious that I'm willing to involve some other people and take two or three more and try to follow this procedure? Is it really that serious? You might find it's dropped at that point. But it also causes the one that's done the wrong to begin to raise that question. This must be a serious matter that he's bringing other brethren with him and they're sitting down and they're talking with me. And then now verse 17, here's the final approach. If he refuses to hear them, after taking two or three more, and they're there as witnesses, not necessarily to take sides, I might add. They're there as witnesses to see what was said and who said what, and here's how he reacted and here's how he didn't react. to establish the case before the church in verse 17. If he refuses to hear them, then tell it to the church. But if he refuses to hear the church, let him be to you like a tax collector and a heathen.
In other words, you finally reject them and no longer have fellowship with them.
Because they're guilty of sin, they wouldn't correct. And so what do you do now? Now you tell it to the whole church.
And now it involves other people. And now it begins to involve more and has greater consequences that we're going to see in just a moment.
Now let's talk about the authority that works.
I've seen the attitude that's wrong. I've seen the action that is right. Now there's something about authority here. And on a cursory reading of Matthew chapter 18, we might begin to think Jesus just shifted gears all of a sudden.
Now he's talking about authority here, and I don't understand. He's talking about assembly and about his presence there. And then he goes back to this matter of relationship. No, he didn't shift gears at all. He's still on the same line. There is a connection here. So beginning at verse 18, he talks about the authority that works. There's some authority that's involved here. What do you mean? Two things I want you to consider. That what is done needs to be approved of God.
Now, something that was said to Peter is established before all the apostles here at verse 18. Assuredly I say to you that whatsoever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven.
That is not a statement to the apostles that says to them, you make up what you want to teach, and whatever you teach, I'll give my approval to that. But it is a statement of inspiration that what the apostles did teach and what they wrote and what they instructed was inspired of God. So here is the source of authority, that which is approved indeed by God.
So I learned from that in the context that whatever we do in discipline should first of all be approved by God. However I decide to approach this person who's done me wrong, however I decide to approach someone who has sinned, whatever I decide to do, whoever I decide to take with me, I need to make sure that it fits with the pattern of authority. And it is bound by God and is approved of God. Because what starts out as a personal matter may soon bind action upon all the rest, wouldn't it? You see the wisdom of God? Let's suppose that I have a problem with some brother over a business transaction and I feel that they've done me wrong.
If I follow the pattern of God, I'm going to try to settle that so it never becomes a part of the church. No one else knows about that. But let's suppose he doesn't correct the wrong, and I think he sinned and he needs to correct that for his soul's sake. And I take with me one or two more, and that he refuses to acknowledge it then. And finally now I'm bringing it before the church. The next thing you know, we may be withdrawing from this brother. It's well established that he sinned. And now this involves everybody. It's not just a personal matter anymore. It involves the whole congregation taking action. So that's why it's so important to make sure that what we're doing is approved by God. But now let's notice at verses 19 and 20 to finish the section.
Not only is there a need for the approval of God in what we do and how we approach our brother, verse 18, but we must make an appeal to God in all matters. And I guess say to you, verse 19, that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. That's interesting. If two of you agree on anything and you ask the Father, it'll be done. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them.
We often quote that in the context of saying, if just two or three are gathered together and we're doing something in the name of God, then God's there with us, and that's true. Let's put it back in its context and see indeed how it fits.
The prayer of two. Could it be those two of verse 15? Could it be the two of verse 15 that he's saying Christ is there? It must have some connection in the context.
Is he talking about the fact that if the two, that where the offended and the offender get together and they resolve that difference and they pray together about that, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them? Why did he mention three? Well, because it might not be settled to the fact that you take one or two more. And now where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. We make an appeal to God and we pray to God. And that teaches a very important lesson, and that is, all don't need to be involved to make this thing work, or verses 15 to 17.
But suppose that there is a difference between two people in the church, and it reaches the point that they take one or two more witnesses, and then it's all settled by the mouth of those two or three witnesses.
And somebody says, well, wait a minute. How did y'all deal with that? How did y'all get this all settled and resolved? Were the elders there? No, they didn't have to be. They didn't have to know about that. Because it was settled at the mouth of two or three witnesses at stage two. And when they made their appeal to God, God was there in the midst of them, was he not? Well, was the preacher there? I think you probably needed him with his Bible to tell you exactly what's going on. No, he didn't need to be there. He didn't have to be. He didn't have to be involved. Because we made an appeal to God, and the promise was, where two or three are gathered together, there I am in the midst of them. That must have something to do with the context. It must have something to do with the context. So what have we seen now? In Matthew 18, 10 through 20. That there's a time when you've been wrong. There's an attitude that's wrong. Don't despise. There's an action that's right. You go settle the matter. And there's an authority that works, and that's the authority of God. Now, we started on the note of the question, have you ever been done wrong? And, of course, your answer is yes. Well, when you have been wronged, the answer in this context is don't despise the person. Don't hate them. Don't look down upon them. Don't make them think now you are superior to them, but go to them with compassion. Settle the difference. And then forgive them, as we're going to notice. Beginning at verse 21 to the end of the chapter is a lesson on forgiveness. In fact, a greater number of verses are devoted to that than to what we've already seen. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?